Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the newest edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and we're excited to talk today about the LDS Church's recent statement about immigration and guideline, a thinking document that sort of sets the stage for the type of approach that they are recommending that politicians and church members take in terms of legislation, as well as just thinking about the issue of immigration, especially illegal immigration. And we're going to use that for a wonderful jumping off point for a wider discussion about immigration. We're going to work hard to tease apart some of the politics/religion connection. We're going to work a bit to humanize and put a personal face upon some of these stories. And we're going to just wrestle with theological issues, scriptural issues, and the different things that seem to come in and inform people's opinions about this. And then at the end, we're going to do a little bit of sort of high-level recommending of policies and have our different guests all sort of share what they think is the right approach to do this. So I'm really grateful for this panel coming on. They're all terrific. And one of the neat things is they're all fresh new voices to the Mormon Matters Podcast during our reboot, and I'll have them each introduce themselves now. One more little thing just to tease in advance is that only two of us here in this discussion are LDS, and so it's exciting to bring in broader Christian and broader legal perspectives and things like that than just a bunch of Mormon progressives talking to each other. So Brent Beal, would you introduce yourself to us and tell us quickly the connection to the Mormon Matters Podcast that comes through your family?
Sure. My name's Brent Beal, and I am I'm a business professor. I'm not sure that qualifies me in and of itself to comment on immigration matters, but I do have a background serving in some local congregations, Spanish-speaking congregations, for about 5 years in Texas and another 3 or 4 years in Louisiana, and so this is an issue that I've followed and I've been familiar with. My connection to the podcast,
Heather.
Dan, you wanted me to comment on that. My wife Heather has been on and enjoyed it.
Heather Olson Beal, who's been on the show about two or three times as Brent's wife. And one of the reasons that I actually thought of Brent is when we did a bit on immigration back in March, Brent was just very active in suggesting things. And I don't know if you were holding up flashcards or something to Heather, but you wrote some really good framing emails and whatnot afterwards. And so I really appreciate that. So you were certainly one of my first people to keep in mind. So grateful to have you.
Glad to be here.
Great. Our next guest is Ben Daniel. Ben, would you share a little bit about yourself with us?
Sure. My name is Ben Daniel. I'm a Presbyterian minister. I'm the pastor of Foothill Presbyterian Church in San Jose, California, where I live with my wife, Ann, and our three kids, two of whom are immigrants. Our daughters, Mimi and Nellie, were both born in China. And I have a son, William, who's a biological child as well. And I live in a predominantly Hispanic community, and many of my neighbors and friends from my kids' school and other people in the community are undocumented migrants. My congregation is a church that of about 200 members who come from about 20 different countries, and so immigration is a really big issue, not just something I think about, but something that affects my life in a lot of really important and wonderful ways.
And you happen to write a book on this subject. Would you,
thank you.
Tell us about that, please?
Yes, yes. My editor, Jana Reese, would be very upset with me if I didn't mention this. I did write a book. It's called Neighbor, Christian Encounters with Illegal Immigration, and it's a book that was published by Westminster John Knox Press last summer, and it's a book that attempts to help readers, predominantly in a Protestant Christian audience, readers, helping people to understand that immigrants, undocumented immigrants in particular, are not just people to be talked about as not just recipients of our charity or people to be feared or helped, but really that the immigrants in our communities really offer us an opportunity for friendship and community and neighborliness. And so that was what I hope to write about in my book. And I hope you'll read it. All of your listeners should read it.
That's right. Yeah. We'll link to it to order through Amazon, or maybe we'll figure out a way to link through our website to where we get 1% or something too.
You should. Yeah.
Yeah. I know that that's possible. I haven't quite figured out how to do it, but maybe I will this week. So that'll be great. Well, thank you, Ben, and thank you to Jana Reese for recommending you and introducing you to me. And I've enjoyed our conversations over the last couple of days. So thank you. Our final panelist is Mark Alvarez. And Mark, we would love to have you tell all about yourself for us.
I'm Mark Alvarez. I'm an attorney. I'm a member of the bars of both Maryland and Utah. I live in Salt Lake City, Utah. I also co-host a Spanish language radio show, Pulso Latino, 3 times a week and do a lot of work with the immigrant community, both documented and undocumented. I write columns in both English and Spanish on the immigration issue.
Great. And your religious affiliation is not LDS. How long have you actually been in Utah and gotten sort of a familiarity with the religion, politics encounter here?
I've lived in Salt Lake City since 1998. I lived in Mexico City from 2007 to 2009. I actually have quite a bit of connection with the LDS Church. My wife is a member of the LDS Church, and I've worked a lot with some of the LDS Church lobbyists on how to address the immigration issue.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to drawing all that out of you as we go. But anyway, thanks to all three of you. And in sort of the pre-circulated documents here, I kind of asked each of you to sort of think about the recent Church's statement. It was issued on June 10th of this year. And I would love just to have your general reaction to it. Let me quickly frame some of the key components of it. It basically reaffirmed that the Church does not advocate anybody coming into any country without legal documentation. But then it focuses on the 12 million or so people who are here right now, currently living without, you know, documents that are really a path to citizenship. And as a religious body, it says that the bedrock moral issue for the Church is how we treat each other as children of God. It wants any legislation and any thinking to think about the people as individuals and as people and not just as statistics and whatnot. But then it affirms the strong feeling that this is an issue that has to be ultimately resolved by the federal government. It's concerned that any state legislation that contains only enforcement-only provisions is likely to fall short of the high moral standard, it says, of treating each other as the way we should, as children of God. And it supports an approach where undocumented immigrants are allowed to square themselves with the law and continue to work without this necessarily leading to citizenship. And then it, again, it reiterates that it's a challenging problem, but they think that compassion, reverence for family, and commitment to a law should all be honored. So it's a pretty broad statement. Brent, when you first read it, what was your reaction?
I was struck by that last portion. I think that's if it's not the last paragraph, it's the second to last paragraph where they basically come out in support of a guest worker program without using that terminology, which seemed like a fairly centrist position to me. I read the statement, and of course, you know, I'll admit that I my initial reaction was that I wish they had gone on a step further and kind of gotten over into the into the amnesty side, if you want to frame it that way, because I think there needs to be, and I'm sure we'll get into this later, some sort of path to citizenship for some of those folks that are here. But, you know, I was pleased that the church had come out and had taken a stand, because I it was my impression, again, I'm not in Utah and I'm not in Arizona, and so I don't really know what it's like on the ground there in those states, but my impression was that the issue was being hijacked a little bit, and that the Mormon name and the church was being attached to some fairly conservative positions that I'm not sure that the leadership of the church was entirely comfortable with. So I kind of saw a little kind of defensiveness in that statement, where they came out and just say, hey, you know, we're actually kind of in the middle here, and we would support kind of a common sense approach that might include a guest worker provision.
Cool. Ben, I would love to have you go next, and sort of from that broad perspective of, you know, you're a member of the clergy of another tradition, you've probably seen other religions, you know, speak out on issues. How does this one fit in with the overall tenor or whatnot that you typically see with a religious institution doing it? And then I'd love to have any specific reactions to the contents as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is it's a really good statement. I agree with Brent that if I had written it, if it had been mine to write, I would have gone further. I think that if you read, you know, what the Catholics are saying, they may be a little more coming down a little stronger on side of things like open borders and amnesty programs and things like that. But I think it's a very good centrist and sensible approach. One of the things, though, I think it paints itself in a corner in a good way, in a way that I would really, that makes me feel encouraged. So I guess it's a good corner they're painting themselves in when they say that they want to see legislation and policy that reflects a reverence for family. One of the problems that any immigration reform policy has to deal with and has to unravel, it's a problem that has to be solved, is the issue of families which have mixed status. So you might have undocumented parents who have U.S. citizen children, families where children are, one child is born in Mexico or another country, and subsequent children are born there, that child's younger siblings are born in the United States, so that siblings have mixed status. Or you'll have, you know, people fall in love, and an undocumented person might marry a citizen, and they would have children. And so if you really want a policy which shows a reverence for family, then the policy has to make a lot of allowances for mixed status families. And so I really hope that the LDS Church will support laws that have reverence for family, and that really take a sober and serious look at how policy will affect mixed status families.
And you mentioned that you think that they're taking a little bit safer approach than the Catholics are right now. In general, though, is it a good idea for a religion to come out and really get into the messy details of the types of legislation that they want it to see? Sort of, they always stay at the guiding moral principles to level. I'd love you to respond to that, and in either of the other panelists, just on that general question of how activist should a church be.
Well, so if I can go first, you know, as someone in my tradition, and which is to say, I'm a Presbyterian, which is I'm a Calvinist, and you know, we our tradition is that there is no such thing as private faith. Faith always must engage society and must engage the world. Now, where I come down on that issue, and I think the Mormon Church has it right here, where I come down on the issue is that it is always good when religious people seek to make the world better for everyone. The problem comes when religious people seek to make the world or society better for themselves and the adherents of their faith to the exclusion of others. So if you have a system, for example, which treats women in ways that are dictated by a particular religious tradition, that's not good. But if you have a faith which seeks to engage the world to make make the world a better and safer place for all women everywhere, that's a good thing. Do you understand the distinction I'm making there? And I really think that this policy that the LDS Church has put out, it makes the world a better place for all God's children. It's not just trying to protect Mormon interests or try to promote a Mormon faith. It really is an attempt, as I see it, to make society better for everyone. And so I applaud that. I think that's good.
And I think the church speaking out on this issue is important in Utah because the church is a major power in the state. Mm-hmm. And while I have reservations because of this constitutional separation between church and state, I think the church statement is certainly a step in the right direction as far as lending civility to the debate. But going to the statement, I think it's important to put the statement in context. There have been other statements by the LDS Church in the past, usually when the immigration debate becomes very heated and hostile, to the point at which some politicians and a lot of politicians in Utah almost use LDS Church doctrine to support an anti-immigrant platform. And I think that the church a number of times has come out and made statements. For example, some years ago, the church made it very clear that undocumented status would not keep somebody from participating in the sacraments of the church. That right. was important because it sent a clear signal to Utah politicians who essentially were saying that undocumented immigrants, or as they would term them, illegals, shouldn't be able to participate in those sacraments. I think, having said that, I'm a bit critical because I think it stops short of truly setting a moral ground for immigration reform. For example, I don't like the idea that the church seems to be supporting a guest worker program because, in my mind, guest worker programs tend to reduce human beings to mere economic actors. Also, the idea of continuing to work without this necessary leading to citizenship, the path to citizenship is already set in immigration law. And for an undocumented immigrant to be able to adjust status somehow but not have that opportunity to at some point become a citizen seems to me an important obstacle that should not be in the law.
So do you think the church would agree with you and they weren't well enough informed, they weren't listening to the right enough people that would argue a position like that for them about there should be some path to citizenship, or do they just feel like they were going to lose any influence with Republican legislators or whatever if they were to, you know, do something that truly looked like full amnesty?
And you definitely hit the critical point. I had sometimes have thought that some people in LDS church leadership are misinformed on this issue, even uninformed. I don't think it's that. I think it's what you pointed out. I think the LDS Church is in a very, very difficult spot in Utah and perhaps nationally because the membership of the LDS Church seems to have been in the past moderately anti-immigrant and in opposition to amnesty programs or even guest worker programs. That may be changing, maybe in part as a result of this statement. But I think that the church has a very, very difficult road ahead because they're steering between a very strong anti-immigrant movement within and among membership of the church and the desire for a more moderate path. Clearly, and Dan, you know this, in Utah, the LDS church growth has occurred in large part in Latin America. And so the LDS church is making this statement that clearly is going to people in Utah. For example, it talks about state-level enforcement policy and that perhaps not being consistent with treating people as children of God. But there's clearly a worldwide audience for the statement as well.
Right.
And so people in Latin America are aware of how the LDS Church may be dealing with the immigration issue in Utah. In fact, I know El Universal, one of the major dailies in Mexico, has covered some of the LDS Church involvement in the immigration issue in Utah, even so far as mentioning the Utah Compact.
Very interesting. And you better, seeing how you brought that term up, would you quickly say what the Utah Compact is for our listeners? Would you do a...
The Utah Compact is a declaration of five principles to guide Utah's immigration discussion. And it essentially says the immigration policy should respect families. Families should not be torn apart as a result of flawed immigration law. So we should look for reform that immigration reform that would respect families. Law enforcement should deal with public safety. Local and state police officers should not be involved in the enforcement of federal immigration law.
Right.
Immigration reform ultimately has to come from the federal government. Immigration reform should respect the economy. So any type of immigration reform should help match our immigration laws to how our economy is functioning. And the last point of the Utah Compact is a free society. Immigrants are integrating into communities across Utah. Immigration reform should address the undocumented and make sure that whatever the undocumented are asked to do, or even and perhaps if they're asked to leave the country, that reform would still respect the values of a free society.
Okay, terrific. Brent, did you have anything you wanted to jump in on before I kind of shift our gears towards something else?
Well, Mark, I really enjoyed what you had to say, and so this is not a criticism at all, and I'm sure that we're going to come back to this. But you referred to the Mormon community as somewhat anti-immigrant, which I thought was really interesting for a lot of reasons. I don't know, and I'm sure we will talk about this later, Dan, so maybe if you want to table this or not, but I think the explanations for why the majority of the membership of the church seem to be on the conservative side of this issue, I think that question is a really interesting one, and I don't know why exactly. I mean, I look at our history, and shoot, I mean, a lot of us are immigrants. I mean, we have, you know, pioneers that crossed the plains. We immigrated, I guess you could say, from one part of the country to the other.
And we were declared illegal. and
you know,
candidates for extermination.
Coming from Europe and coming from England. And so I think if you went to the average member of the church and said, are you anti-immigrant? They would say, oh, well, no, of course not. But yet they align themselves politically with positions that are very anti-immigrant, at least in this case on this issue. And I think that's something maybe we can get into a little bit later.
Yeah, and I'll quickly respond. I think it's interesting because polling in Utah and even polling among people of the members of the LDS Church shows that people supported an Arizona-style solution in Utah. By the same token, they also supported a path to citizenship. And I think that's true, and perhaps I'm overstating and characterizing the members of the LDS Church as moderately anti-immigrant. It's almost a confusion. In fact, that's one of the things about the Utah Compact, trying to develop principles for discussion. I think when we get into the details of immigration, people start seeing others, even the undocumented, as human beings. And perhaps, I think your criticism is right on. Perhaps it's not anti-immigrant. It's more reaction to the frustration of having seen our immigration system essentially be stagnant for 20, 25 years.
Well, the other thing is that Mormons, members of the LDS Church, are like every other American, right? I mean, and I think a lot of Americans are anti-immigrant, regardless of whether they're members of the LDS Church or they're members of the Presbyterian Church or Catholics. That's just part of what is afflicting our society right now. The writer Bill Bryson once said something. I'm going to mess the quote up, but he said something like, the way Americans think of immigration is they think it was a great idea for their ancestors to come, but now they don't want anybody else to do it. You know, that's sort of the way we always have been, whether you're talking about, you know, the Chinese Exclusion Act or, you know, race-based quotas that were mandated throughout the early parts of the first half of the 20th century. You know, we have been and remain a very anti-immigrant society. And so the extent to which members of the LDS Church are just part of the larger American society, I think you see that reflected there, right?
I agree. And I definitely, yeah, you're dead on. Let's go, guys. A couple of you left openings here to really personalize this. I think it was Mark, one of you said something about, you don't want them just treated like economic, you know, players. You definitely want to have a human face into it. And I know that each of you, through your various interactions, are interacting with you know, undocumented folks all the time. And I would love each of you to share a story or two, or maybe just tell of a person or two that sort of helps put a human face on the people who are here, what brought them here to this country, what their hopes and dreams are, what their actual living circumstances are, some of the abuses that they sometimes suffer and they have no way to get redress on some of those things. And so whatever you would want to pick as far as your own experience with a person or two, I'd love you each to share something like that to begin with. So I don't want to keep going in our same order, so why don't I just go how you appear on my screen from left to right. Ben, would you start? Then we'll go to Brent, and then we'll go to Mark.
Sure. I'm often seen as the person furthest to the left in not just on your screen. But yeah, so I mean, the undocumented person that I interact with probably most is a woman named Maria Teresa, and she is the mother of a girl in my daughter's fourth grade class. And my daughter and her daughter have been in school together since kindergarten and sort of in the same classes and stuff. And Maria Teresa is from Mexico, and I don't know why she and her former husband decided to cross the border without papers and come to San Jose. But they did, and they had three children here. The oldest is a ninth grader, and the youngest is in the second grade. And what's sort of heartbreaking about her story, and her husband left her, so now Maria Teresa is raising three girls as a single mother, and she is undocumented. And her youngest daughter has some fairly serious needs, medical needs. I don't know all of the details, but she has to see a specialist once a month, roughly. And the specialists live on the other side of town, and to take public transportation from our side of town, where the poor people live, to the wealthier part of town where the good doctors are, would take 2 hours each way. And so Maria Teresa drives, and she drives, but in California, she's not allowed to drive because, you know, we have, like most states, revoked driving privileges from those who don't have visas. So, in order to address the very serious medical needs of her daughter, in other words, in order to keep her daughter alive, Maria Teresa risks deportation at least once a month to drive her daughter to the other side of town to get the proper medical care. If Maria Teresa gets in an accident and it's not her fault, she will be arrested and deported, or could be. It's a risk that she takes in order to take care of her daughter. And it breaks my heart every time I see her behind the wheel of a car, and she drives your kids to school and does all the same things that I do in terms of, you know, taking care of my kids and driving them around, but only for her. The act of driving, which is really an act of survival in the Silicon Valley because we don't have good public transportation. For that, she risks deportation and separation from her three U.S. citizen children. And that is something that, I say a prayer for her every time I see her in her car.
Very interesting. And maybe we'll cycle back a couple of times. Why don't I move on to Brent? Do you have a person or some generalizations based upon real people that you can sort of ground in their stories for us?
Sure. I was at Texas A&M in Bryan College Station here in Texas. And I was asked, our family was asked to go over and start attending this small congregation of Spanish-speaking members of the church. It was a Spanish branch, that's what we call it. Mm-hmm. And I remember vividly going over there and, you know, starting to meet, both my wife and I speak Spanish, and so we started to attend church services with these folks. And I just remember kind of this introduction into what their lives were like, and I just remember being shocked at how it worked, at just kind of the harsh reality of what it was like to be an illegal, undocumented worker here in the U.S. I have this memory of going over to this trailer park and going inside one of these trailers, and I was with a couple men from the branch there. They were here working for their families. I mean, they sent almost all the money that they earned home. And I remember walking into that trailer and realizing that there must have been 10 or 12 men that lived in this trailer. And then figuring out, I can't remember exactly what the dollar amounts were, but they couldn't sign contracts. And so even though there were, it was a college town and there were apartments all over, didn't have access to any of that housing. And they were paying, if I remember, I think it was $75 a week each.
Wow.
To live in this trailer, I remember adding that up and thinking that's insane. I mean, four or five of them could get together and they could go rent a nice apartment just right across the street or two streets over. But, they didn't have that access. And then, I would find out that, what kind of rates they were paying to send money home. And it mm-hmm. seemed incredible that it cost that much money just to send money, via Western Union or whatever it was. And, of course, they didn't have access to bank accounts, and they couldn't get a driver's license. They the mobility was restricted, and just all the inconveniences and sacrifices that they were making. And then I was also exposed really to how hard they worked. I mean, they're for the most part the people that I ran into, at least initially in that branch, were here because of extreme economic conditions in their home countries. They were aware of the wage differential, and they really were here sacrificing to send that money back home to support their families. I mean, that's how their families were living. So I would see them involved in the construction industry, and I'm sure we'll cycle back to some of this, but just realizing that because they were being paid the way they were being paid, of course, there was no contract here. They would be exploited. They would work on jobs, and then they just wouldn't be paid, and they had no recourse. Oftentimes what they were doing was dangerous. I remember a couple of guys were roofers. One of these guys falls off a roof and gets injured, and of course, because it's a cash transaction, they're not covered by workers' compensation. There's no recourse. And so I just remember just it's not what I expected. It wasn't what I expected. I really wasn't aware of some of these immigration issues, and then just to be kind of thrown into it in that way, where I saw things there in that first year or two in that little branch. I think I got a picture of it from the inside, and it wasn't pretty. It didn't make me proud of the way we as Americans were treating those folks that were here.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, one story I've written about and talked about quite a bit is the story of Vanessa, who is a student, high school student from Oakland, California, who was traveling through Salt Lake City on her way to Washington for a National March on Immigration last year. And she came, had a very nice line, "We are all humans and immigrants in this world." But she talked to me, and she actually said her full name before print reporters, before television cameras, very boldly just came out and said, "I'm an undocumented immigrant," which as an attorney, I cringed at, but I really respected the courage she had. She told me when I interviewed her that she had to turn down scholarships for prep schools because she was undocumented. This was a woman who spoke English and Spanish fluently with English without an accent. And yet she was looking to go to the university at some point, and knowing that there were some avenues that would be closed to her. For example, as an undocumented student, she would not be able to apply for many scholarships. As an undocumented student, she would find it very difficult even to get loans for her study. I work a lot with undocumented students at the University of Utah, Utah Valley University, and I hear very similar stories about people who achieve academically, qualify for scholarships, but can't fill out the paperwork to actually get the scholarships, because in filling out the paperwork, a person would have to lie about citizenship or resident status. I interviewed another woman who came here as an undocumented immigrant. She came to Utah, came here from Mexico. She had family in Utah, came and didn't speak English well, got very frustrated. But because her family had made many sacrifices, and I'll call this woman Sarah, her family had made many sacrifices, she thought about going back to Mexico but decided to stay. Over time, she became involved at the Guadalupe School, which is a nonprofit organization in Salt Lake City, which helps people with English, learned English, found a way to become a legal permanent resident, took business classes, started her own business. She started a business about 6 years ago. That business now employs 7 people. This year, she's going to apply for U.S. citizenship. But it's an interesting story because it's a story of a person's arc from undocumented status to citizen. And for me, it illustrates how most immigrants who come here, be they documented or undocumented, come here with dreams, come here with aspirations. People don't move to foreign countries because they want to fail. They move because they're looking to progress for themselves, for their families, and ultimately that progress helps the communities they live in, the state and the country. It's unfortunate that for most people who are undocumented, there was no path open like the path Sarah was able to find. But she'll become a U.S. citizen. My guess is she'll become a U.S. citizen this year, has a thriving business. I hope that through immigration reform, her success can be replicated by other immigrants, both documented and undocumented.
Great, and we'll get your recommendations and everybody else's thoughts towards the end about how to do that. Let me play devil's advocate here a little bit, and mostly because I know that you guys can handle these questions. First of all, what percentage of people who come here illegally are you sensing are people who aren't working for good purposes, and those who end up perhaps being people who participate in a lot of criminal activity and things like that, are they falling into that for reasons of opportunities and doors being slammed to them? Is it sort of a frustration and a something that sends them in that direction, whereas they might not if these other doors were open? So what's, for those who want to look at the examples of the negative examples, how many of them are there, and what are the reasons for them being in that situation?
So can I take a stab at that? Because I did some research on that very issue when I was writing my book, Neighbor. And actually, the undocumented population as a whole is more law-abiding than the citizen population of the United States. And the reason for that is because the undocumented population has, you know, for the most part, have really made some extreme sacrifices to get here. And they pretty much know better than to mess it up. You know, they've got way more to lose than American citizens. And now there is a problem with cross-border violence and with drug trafficking. But I think a lot of that is actually being done by American citizens. I think that, you know, we certainly have a lot of gangs and criminal activity here in East San Jose where I live, but my sense is that those are U.S. citizen, you know, U.S. born kids who grow up in the hood and life is hard for them for whatever reason they you know get involved in gangs and even get involved in the gangs with connections to the larger drug lords in Mexico. But by and large, the people who cross the border looking for work are really careful about following the law because they don't want to get deported. So that's my experience with it.
Cool. And what about the economic drain question? That the cost of education, healthcare, the different things that many are benefiting from being a drain. You know, the whole taking jobs from other people. I know that. Why don't I just start with you, Mark? I know you can address that and just sort of frame that for us.
Very quickly, I'm going to also touch the myth of immigrant crime. Because there was a study done. It's the paradox of assimilation. Now, this is a study done in the Latino community. Latino immigrants have much, much lower crime than Latinos who were born in the United States. And it's for the reason that was just mentioned. An immigrant knows, even a documented immigrant knows, if he or she commits a crime, that's probably a ticket out of the United States. A person's going to get kicked out. So there's a huge disincentive to committing crime. The paradox is, as Latinos become assimilated here, or if Latinos are born here, they have more of a tendency to be involved in crime, which is a bit of a paradox. As far as the economic impact, Giovanni Perry, who's an economist at the University of California, Davis, did a study a couple of years ago, which showed that even the undocumented labor force helps the economy in general. Wages tend to go up, it's just slightly, and it depends on where you are, but they go up slightly as a result of the undocumented workforce. That's largely the reason is because people specialize in jobs. Some undocumented workers complement workers who are already here. Now, there's a catch. The economic impact is hard to measure. It's also unevenly felt. Those people who are competing with the undocumented workers in the same industry, looking for the same jobs, those people short-term probably suffer. Medium-term, long-term, they're actually helped because they tend to get a little more education or a little more training. Also, undocumented workers create jobs. They create supervisory positions into which people who may be displaced in the short-term can then aspire later on. And so it is hard to measure. As far as education, I think education is always a societal good. Even if undocumented children are being educated in our schools, the truth is those undocumented children are probably not leaving. It's better for our society that those undocumented children or citizen children of undocumented parents get an education, because over the medium term, over the longer term, those children who become adults are going to contribute more to our society and to our economy.
Right, right. Good. And I know that you mentioned, at least on a podcast I listened where you participated in, Ben, mm-hmm. Just the price of food and certain other industries, the lifestyle that many Americans have depend in a long, long ways upon this labor.
Right. I mean, if you are the kind of person who likes to eat a Big Mac, for example, I mean, the amount of savings you get. I mean, if you want to spend, I don't eat Big Macs. I don't know. What does a Big Mac cost now?
$3 maybe.
$3, right. Yeah. $3, $4. I mean, it would be probably twice that if we were employing a documented workforce. And the truth is that Americans simply won't do the work in our fields. And they can't. I mean, if we were to deport all of the undocumented farm workers in our country, there would be a food crisis, because we simply couldn't get enough people out of American cities and into the countryside and into the agricultural areas to plant the next crop rotation. It just wouldn't work. There would be a food crisis. There would be a spike in food costs, and it would be felt around the world. So really, We absolutely rely upon undocumented people, not only to feed us, but to feed us in such a way that Americans pay less money for food than anybody else in the world, in part. I also wanted to, if it's okay, something that you said, Mark, about education, in terms of educating children. The children who come here to the United States and are in our schools, I have a hard time calling them illegal immigrants, because I don't think that they made the decision. They're not adults who make a decision about whether to come to the United States or not. So really, it's not like we're rewarding illegal behavior. We're simply doing what we can to make sure that the children who are here by no fault of their own are able to grow up and participate in the economy. So sorry to jump around on you, but that's the point I wanted to make.
That's good. I want to take us into the politics religion thing. This is a Mormon Matters podcast, and we're generally talking a little bit more about religious ideas and sensibilities and whatnot. But I appreciate this, and feel free to illustrate with more individuals and stories as we go. Brent, you've been the quietest one here. I don't know if it was my fault or whatever, but is there anything you wanted to say before I kind of take us into that direction?
Just enjoying the conversation. I'll make one small observation. You know, I remember getting in fights with my siblings when I was younger, and I'm sure we've all had this experience. We, you know, I get in a fight with my sister or my brother, gets out of hand, and so we, you know, we find ourselves before one of our parents or both trying to explain what's going on. And, you know, I can remember when it was time for my sister to give her side of the story, she would tell my parents what had happened, and I often would just be, you know, just dumbfounded. Like, you know, why is she presenting it this way? It seems incredibly obvious that she's lying, and my version is the correct one. I have that same reaction on the economic side here when I see people upset that somehow undocumented workers are taking advantage of us. I kind of feel like it's my sister, you know, I'm 10 again, and my sister's telling this whopper of a tale to my parents, because I don't understand it. I mean, maybe this is just the business professor in me, but I look at the macro kind of economic model here, and I see this big arrow coming in one side, which is cheap labor, and I don't see any logical way that hurts our economic system. I mean, capitalism depends on cheap labor. You just look at the history of how capitalism kind of has evolved. And, it just seems so clear to me that we're exploiting them. They're not exploiting us. That I just have a hard time. I have a hard time even seeing the other side of the argument. And so it is interesting.
A lot of it would probably involve a slippery slope, and you know, maybe you can let us know at the end if you really are talking about you'd love a true open border, or if you know those different types of things. But no, I understand that mindset where it's like you know, the sun is shining and you're saying it's dark, you know, or something. Please.
Right. There is one little catch to that, and that is that there are some workers who are hurt. I mean, I believe they're hurt in the short term. Consumers clearly benefit. Business clearly benefits. And in that, society and the economy benefit as well. But there are some workers who are hurt because those are the people I'm most sympathetic to, who I would characterize as being on the anti-immigrant side. While I very strongly support amnesty, I'm sympathetic to those workers who are angry because they've seen their wages stagnate. And maybe as a result of the undocumented workforce. I think they're helped longer term, but short term, I think they do suffer.
Right. Yeah.
Sure. No, I and I should have, I'm up at a pretty high level looking at, you know, the overall economy. And, you know, it's easy when you look at it from a bird's eye position like that to dismiss some of the pain that goes on underneath when you talk about things like unemployment rate and churn and, you know, people changing jobs and changing industries, and there is a lot of pain. I would turn that around and say that as economy evolves, that's just a feature of the way we've set up our system here. I mean, it's a feature of capitalism. I mean, you have obsolescence, you have industries that are going to stagnate and decline, and you have other industries that are going to be ascendant, and there's a lot of kind of transitional pain as people move in and out. So I totally agree with what you're saying. I mean, you can certainly find, especially in construction, for example, mm-hmm. in some of the areas around here. I mean, it's tough to compete with illegal labor. It's impossible in some cases. So certainly there is some pain there.
Good. Appreciate that, guys. All right. Let's go quickly into, well, to me, this was what I had sort of imagined our discussion would talk about the most. And then when Ben and Mark came along as potential guests that I'm so grateful to have, I definitely wanted to take us a little bit more into specific proposals and whatnot, too. But I'd like to spend some time with the politics-religion intersection, perhaps throw out the statement and have you guys react to it, that it seems to me that, well, one of the scandals of monotheism, so we'll talk about monotheism at this time, is the idea that you have a God. God is a sovereign God, and yet this God obviously has chosen not to make 100% of his or its will known to us. In other words, it leaves people with this mass of scripture or religious documents and guiding principles and things like that that they're able to pick and choose from as something to pay more attention to or less attention to others. And so the statement I'd want you to react to is that in many ways, whereas I think a lot of people believe that their political positions are come and emerge out of their religious tradition and their religious backgrounds and the resources of their traditions, it's actually their politics that leads them to pick and choose the religious principles that they want to then hang their hat on stronger. So I don't know if I said that well. You guys know what I'm talking about?
I think so.
Okay. Brent, why don't I start with you? Critique that statement, flesh it out for us a little bit, and then we'll turn to Ben next, and then Mark.
Seems like a rabbit hole. there's a lot there. So you're talking about the causal error going both ways. You're wondering if it's is it the religion that affects the politics, or is it the politics that affects the choice of religion?
Right, and I would think that most people think that it's their religion that helps them choose their politics. My argument would be, or my statement that I want you to critique, is that it seems that it's the religion, it's the politics that shapes what piece of religion they grab.
Okay. I think that's an interesting statement. I think if we're all honest with ourselves, I think we do that to a certain degree. I'm more familiar with Mormonism than any other religious tradition, but I suspect I do that. if you catch me in an honest moment, I'll try to hang my hat on the pieces of the religion that seem to fit best with the way I see things politically.
Right, good. And I still want to hit this question with everybody, but here's where I want to go next. If religion is supposedly transcendent in people's minds, what pieces of the general Judeo-Christian and even the Mormon scriptures and whatnot could the folks who want an enforcement only, that really want to emphasize, what are the pieces of religion that they're grabbing onto versus at least within the Christian tradition, what seems to be the, what would Jesus do? And it certainly tends to mostly shake out for people that he's looking at the marginalized, the poor, the outcast, and concentrating there.
Just one quick comment and then pass the baton. One thing in the Mormon tradition that I see people grabbing onto that seem more conservative on this particular issue is this idea of just respect for the law, law and order. We need to subject ourselves to the authority of consensus for the law or government or however you want to frame it, and that we have a group of people here that are breaking the law, and so that in a lot of people's minds seems to kind of end the debate. Well, they've broken the law. So, until we get that straightened out, we can't really do anything else. And I obviously don't subscribe to that, but I think that would be an example of what you're talking about.
They're definitely looking at that. They're definitely looking at that, but then they're ignoring the history, if it's within the Mormon tradition, at least they're ignoring the history of its own, of the tradition itself that often fought the law of the land in order for their own interests and things like that. But okay, so in general, Mark, you've sort of said that my initial statement about religion and politics and what has priority sort of matches for you. Ben, does it match for you, or where would you want to complicate that thesis?
Well, I mean, it is true. I think that Brent's honesty around that is one that I would have to I'd have to echo, in that I think that often we do bring our politics to faith and look within our traditions for ways to support what, you know, our preconceived ideas. I think that we all do that to some extent. With the immigration issue, what I have found, however, is that when I was working on my book, I sat down and I decided I wanted to find a good couple of passages from the Bible that I could highlight to sort of show that Christians should be pro-immigrant, or that we should care for immigrants. And so I kind of started from the beginning of the Bible, and I kind of leafed through and started thinking about all the stories. And what I realized is that starting in the Old Testament, starting with the expulsion from Eden, the people of God are always on the move. That whenever faithfulness is happening, there is motion, that there is some kind of immigration, there's some sort of itinerant, it's an itinerant faith. And that carries through to the New Testament. You know, Jesus doesn't have a home. Jesus is always walking around and moving. He's constantly on the move. And he then sends the disciples out into the world to proclaim the gospel. And both the Old Testament and the New Testament, when the Jewish rabbis sat down to figure out what was going to be in their canon, they did it at a time when their temple had just been destroyed, and they were forced out of Jerusalem, and so they look back to stories of exile and exodus in forming their canon, and the Christian spirituality, the Christian faith and theology that started in the New Testament also was formed in that time of exile from the Jerusalem temple and exile from the Jewish tradition. And so Christians always talked about themselves as sojourners and as travelers. And I think that's carried through to what I know of the Mormon tradition as well. I mean, I think that if I was arguing this as a Mormon, I would point out the fact that the first way God appears in the Book of Mormon is in the pillar of fire, and that is an image taken directly from the Exodus story, where the pillar of fire leads the children of God out of Egypt and into the wilderness and towards the Promised Land. I would talk about the stories of immigration to the New World. I would talk about the history of sort of the later day history of the pioneers and stuff. It's also, I think, part of that sacred story. So I think that both within Judaism, within Christianity, and within Mormonism, you have this unbroken thread of an immigration spirituality. So sure, I guess I went looking for that as someone who had already made up my mind, but it was really confirmed there for me. Once I really got into the tradition.
Were there pieces that you would say, if you held them to the, you know, an objective standard, that would argue against the immigration positions that you hold? Were there passages of scripture that might trouble your case?
No. The one argument that comes up again and again is this argument which Brent already mentioned, which is the argument that we have to follow the law and we have to be good citizens and we have to pay attention to that. That would make more sense to me if it weren't written at a time when it was against the law to be a Christian, and if we weren't worshiping someone who was crucified because he was a criminal who didn't obey the laws. I think that the whole notion that the people who wrote the New Testament and first read the New Testament were really concerned about following laws just doesn't hold water. And throughout the tradition, throughout the Christian tradition, certainly, we have been called upon as Christians to break immoral laws. And we've done that. I mean, whether it was Christians sitting in lunch counters in the South, or Christians refusing to turn runaway slaves. And I mean, you could go on and on. I mean, there's certainly, as a Reformed Christian, as a Reformed Protestant, there's a great history within the Reformation of Christians refusing to obey the laws set by the Catholic Church. My wife's family, my mother-in-law, is from the Anabaptist tradition, and there's that great pacifist tradition, which refused to pick up arms and to fight.
Absolutely.
There's a huge Christian tradition of breaking unjust laws, and so I'm not convinced by those who say that we must have an enforcement only immigration policy based on the passages in the Bible that tell us to be good citizens.
Very good. And Mark, I definitely want to go to you. Brent, anything in the Mormon canon, the specific to LDS canon that you're spotting, besides the 12th Article of Faith about honoring, obeying, sustaining the law of the land wherever you are, sort of thing, anything in there that troubles the case for a more progressive legislative approach to the undocumented population?
You're asking me to see past my own biases?
Yeah, I've been thinking today, and other than, you know, justice is often talked about as not being able to be, you know, robbed, and yet every one of those passages has an equal mercy or even a mercy overpowering justice sort of feel to it. So I was just wondering if there were things that you spot in specifically within Mormon scripture or teaching that would sort of lend to what we see as the dominant position, at least among most Mormons at this time.
This probably is an indication of my position more than anything else, but I really can't find anything. Not in the broader Christian tradition. I don't see anything really there, and I'm not sure what I would grab onto in the Mormon tradition besides this idea of just law and order. There just doesn't seem to be much. I mean, just looking at our own history that we've already kind of alluded to, I mean, we have a long history of resisting immoral laws when it's been convenient for us, at least. So I'm not sure if I were trying to argue the conservative side of this, what I would grab onto.
Yeah, anyway, that's where I'm at, too, and I know that some of our listeners will say, you needed a conservative on this program, and for anybody to speak for themselves, and honestly, everybody, I tried. as several of you who've worked with me behind the scenes, we worked very, very hard, and that actually brings up the issue that I hope someday that this podcast and its listener base will include more people like that we can turn to bring on a program like this to speak for it. But, you know, at the moment, this is a progressive Mormon podcast, and we will kind of play that out until we can broaden our base a little bit. But I'm appreciative of all that. But I'm with you, Brent. I couldn't think of anything specific either. So, Mark, maybe you're actually the one who, on the ground working with these issues and bumping heads with these politicians that are calling for enforcement only, what are you hearing in their rhetoric where they refer to scriptural positions?
Well, I hear from some conservatives that basis for some what I characterize as anti-immigrant legislation in the 12th Article of Faith, honoring the law. But I think going to scripture, there's also the idea of welcoming the stranger in our midst. And so I think we can go to scripture to find what supports our politics. I like a quote by Vladimir Nabokov: "Reality is a word that must always be used in quotation marks." And when I'm talking with some conservative politicians, I sometimes use the argument: the real challenge in immigration is occurring because of bad law, not because of bad people. And in private, some of those conservative politicians will actually acknowledge that. I've been told by someone who's very prominent anti-immigration activist in the state of Utah, I have to say I'm against amnesty. This is him talking to me, because I'm speaking to a base that needs to hear that. Having said that, privately, even conservative politicians are starting to recognize something has to be done to address the 12 million people who are living in the United States without documents, and mass deportations won't work. Going a little bit to perhaps, I don't know if this is scripture or not, but immigration involves borders. Borders are a huge challenge in a globalized world because humans migrate. If we address the immigration issue, can we? I think it would be helpful if we started to think immigration is not about them. Immigration is about all of us. That's a phrase from a law professor at the University of Valencia, Spain, Javier de Lucas. Mm-hmm. How we address immigration is going to say a lot about us. If there's an immigration challenge, if there's an immigration problem, we should not place the entire brunt of the blame on the people who have violated the immigration law, perhaps by coming here without documents or overstaying visas. We share in that blame. And if there's shared blame, we have to share the responsibility for addressing the issue and not try to mete out all the punishment on the people who are here without documents. And I think about the Bible, if we're going to scripture, maybe it's the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. I think with the LDS Church statement, I think there's the idea behind this statement, which I think is saying immigration is at some point a moral issue. Let's be more forgiving. Let's be more civil in addressing this issue, and let's not dehumanize people who may be here in violation of immigration law.
Very good. Thanks very much. It's a difficult issue. It's a difficult dance, religion, politics. What's mine is mine, and I want to ward off threats for that. And yet, I know that most religion, I think, points to the embrace of others. One of the Book of Mormon passages that I was thinking should be somewhat transcendent in this is shortly after the Book of Mormon describes Christ coming to the new world, there's a 200-year reign of peace, sort of a Zion society sort of is described as lasting here on the American continent. And one of the claims there is that there was no more ITES, Lamanites, Nephites, Amalekites, and all the different separations from people, and so the society was united and cooperative and all that stuff, and that should always be a goal that sort of pushes us forward and stands out there. It's certainly not practical in the immediate, but that's the direction I think religion calls us to, and my hope sometime is that we really do spend our time and examine where are our positions coming from. Are they coming from our highest selves, the highest aspirations of Scripture and whatever revelation we hold as binding towards us, or is it coming simply from habit or from scared rhetoric or things like that? So anyway, I'm going to leave this at that point, and thank you guys for all your contributions right there. I want to close the podcast. I'd love us to wrap up in the next 10 minutes or so with each of you proposing at least a few thoughts about the way ahead. What should, what in the LDS statement or just in general what direction might we want to go if you were to all of a sudden get more involved in politics and starting to push legislation? Why don't we start with Ben? We'll go to Brent, and then Mark. I know you're actually doing this for a living, partly. We'll end with you.
Yeah. Right. So I guess spiritually, I would say we have to realize that God didn't write the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. That God didn't set the United States border. But as a matter of practical things that I'd like to see changed. In my book, Neighbor, I actually propose five changes that I think are needed. This is just in the introduction. It's not mostly a book about policy, but I felt like I needed to say this. First, I think that there has to be a way for the United States government to provide seasonal work for people. And because that's something that I heard on both sides of the border. Most people who come to do things like agricultural work and other kinds of things, other kinds of seasonal work, would really rather come seasonally and go home. And I would like to see that be made possible. It would be a way of keeping families together. A parent could just go away for 3 months, pick lettuce in the Salinas Valley, then come home, and I think that would be really good. I think families should be kept together. I think that current laws that separate mixed status spouses and deport parents and separate parents from their children, I think those need to be changed. Because it doesn't help anybody to separate a child from her parents. I think that children brought across the border by their parents should be treated differently than adults who immigrated here alone. Even when those children grow up and become adults, there has to be a way to differentiate between people who made the choice to come here and those who didn't. And the other thing is, I really think, we haven't talked about this, but if I could, I would go down to the border and say, Mr. Obama, tear down this wall. I really don't like the system of walls and barriers that are being set up along our border, because what they're doing, they're not keeping people from crossing the border. they are encouraging people to go out into the desert and cross the border in really dangerous ways and in dangerous places, often at the cost of human life. And I really think that that's something that we need to look at seriously at changing. And finally, I think that we need to have borders that control goods and services. That's an important part of an international system. You have to have borders. But I think that immigration enforcement should be done, if we're going to do it, if we're going to be going after people, it shouldn't be, we shouldn't be punishing the people who are the poorest and most vulnerable. If we're going to punish people, it should be, you know, businesses who abuse workers, not the workers themselves. So those are my 5 points.
Great. Thank you very much. Brent, what's your thoughts?
This might make it obvious why I'm not a politician, I guess. I'm not sure. if I could sell any of this, I guess if I had a wish list, I would like to see the debate shift. These aren't recommendations really about specific laws that I would like to see passed. As much as they are about how I would like to see us as a country take some responsibility for the illegal immigration problem as a moral issue. And I mentioned that before. I mean, for me, it really is, you know, I look at this data, I look at some of the economic studies that have been done, and you know, I'm aware of some of the arguments out there, but to me, it really is a case of us exploiting a group of people, a class of people that oftentimes are in pretty dire circumstances, given situations in their home countries, and it doesn't seem morally right to me. And so I cringe a little bit when the solution to this, when a politician steps forward and says, well, we need a guest worker program. Because to me, that seems like continuing to exploit that class of people, but doing it only in a slightly more open way.
Right.
So I would like to, if at all possible, I would like to see some recognition of what's going on economically, kind of a macro level, and see that reflected in the debate. And then I would like to see an honest discussion about what a path to citizenship would look like. How should we structure that? I think somebody that comes over here and devotes 10, 12, 15 years to you know, picking our fruit, that it's only fair if they want to become American citizens and they want to contribute in that way, that we allow them to do so. That only seems fair to me. And so I wish we could get there. But it seems like the debate is just a long ways from that point.
Mark, I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but I know you've done some work on sort of trying to bring the word up amnesty in a sort of a less politically charged way. So if maybe you could at least start your response on Brent's comment there, and then feel free to add any of your other policy changes.
Well, I do think we need to get over our fear of the word amnesty. What we're looking for is reform. Sometimes people who are looking for comprehensive immigration reform, they would treat undocumented immigrants with dignity, want to avoid amnesty and use legalization, regularization, earned adjustment. No matter what we call it, the opposition is going to call it amnesty. So I say just go ahead. It's amnesty. I think that the reform has to treat people as human beings. And so I agree with what the prior speaker said on guest worker programs. Guest worker programs that do not allow for a change in attitude. Perhaps a person comes as a seasonal worker, comes as somebody who's going to work for 3 years, may change his or her mind. I think it's only right that our immigration system allows for that flexibility. And so to treat people just as guest workers or temporary workers, I think reduces human beings to the level of mere economic actors. For me, there are three fundamental questions for immigration. Looking outside, how should we reform our system for people who want to come here? Second, how should we structure our enforcement mechanisms at the border and internally to ensure compliance with and respect for the law? And then the third question, and maybe the most difficult one, looking inside, how should we deal with the undocumented immigrant population? I think first, to go almost in reverse order, we need to resolve the immigration status for between 11 and 12 million people in the United States. I think those who qualify and should be given an opportunity to have residence in the United States. The only people I would disqualify are those with serious criminal records. Secondly, I think we should streamline family-based immigration processes. Our family-based immigration process has essentially been stagnant since 1965. In one category, there's a waiting list of 23 years. That shouldn't happen. I think waiting lists should be cut to a maximum of 6 years. Perhaps that means changing the categories a bit, but the challenge is, how do we streamline the processes? We need to adjust family-based and employment-based immigration quotas to our societal and economic needs. If we have a dynamic economy, a dynamic society, why shouldn't we have a dynamic immigration system? When the economy is strong, more visas should be available. More visas for highly skilled workers and for semi-skilled or unskilled workers. I think the laborers who work in our fields are treated very, very poorly in our current immigration system. We need to adjust our immigration procedures for economic competitiveness globally. Other countries are now changing immigration systems to be more competitive in a global economy. The United States will have to do the same, or it will start to suffer economically. An agile economy will require an agile immigration system. We need implementation of genuine employment verification. That would be far more successful and far less costly than militarization of the border. We don't need open borders or closed borders. We need smart borders. But to pump more and more money into border militarization is to pump money down the drain. We need flexible border policy that addresses criminal and security threats but allows orderly flows of people and commerce. Internally, we should try to better integrate integrate immigrants. Instead of telling immigrants they have to learn English, we should try to provide opportunities so that they can learn English. Every immigrant, be he or she undocumented or documented, knows that learning English is key to progress in the society. We don't need to insult them with its insistence on English-only laws. Lastly, immigration is an international challenge. The government of the United States needs to collaborate more, especially with immigrant-sending countries. The real way to address immigration challenges in the United States is to start to address economic disparities between the United States and immigrant-sending countries.
Okay, very interesting. And I don't know that you mentioned it here, but I know that you've been a strong voice against any of these state-based resolutions, mostly because, you know, in the case of the Utah law, there was some talk when it was first passed, this HB 116, which was the guest worker track, that the legislator was in some ways trying to make the federal government step up and do this. They recognized that this was going to go into court cases and it was going to be declared unconstitutional and this stuff, but their idea was to spur the federal government. And you're just basically saying, you know, to the LDS Church statement, which sort of seems to support 116 and things like that, you're saying forget it, right?
Well, that's true, because under Title 8 United States Code, Section 1324A, a company cannot hire an undocumented worker. The state, if it passes a law like, well, if it implements a law like HB 116, which would give a state work permit to an undocumented worker, would essentially be telling that worker and the company that hires the worker to violate federal law. That's unconstitutional under the Supremacy Clause. And nothing I've seen from any legislator in the state of Utah, from the governor, from the attorney general of the state, has shown me that there's any exception for a pilot program to be created in Utah. And so I would ask the LDS Church, if it provides its statement at some point, to make it very clear immigration reform has to come from the federal government. The United States does not need a patchwork system of 50 different immigration systems throughout the country.
Right, right. And in some ways they've made the statement, but they backed off by sort of at least indicating in that statement that the guest worker thing might be, anyway, they just need to be clearer and pick it one way or the other.
Yeah,
for sure.
And to be fair, I think that politicians I've talked to know the state work permit system is not really going anywhere. It's more a message to the federal government. The problem is that message has given false hope to many people in the undocumented community. I would like to see more people recognize this is a political game to try to get the federal government to act. The idea of Utah implementing its own separate immigration system flies in the face of the Constitution. It also flies in the face of logic.
Right. Terrific. Well, you guys, this has been a heck of a conversation. It was interesting to have four of us basically in agreement on many of the pieces. I know that there were some voices and some positions not represented here. And the good thing about this podcast is it has a blog that people can go to, and that we can have a robust discussion there. So I encourage all listeners to weigh in, to tell us what we've left out of this conversation, to add more of a clear voice to the positions that none of us were able to articulate, or that at least hadn't been persuaded by. Ben, thank you very much for being here. Brent, you too. Mark, you too. And I hope that you go to MormonMatters.org over the next few days after this is released. It'll be released Tuesday night, the 21st. But I'll alert you guys when it's up there, and I hope you'll visit our blog every once in a while and take any questions that might be directed at you, and I'll certainly I'll keep poking you towards that direction, if especially people do want to engage you directly. But really appreciate your perspectives, your expertise, your good hearts, your stories that you're able to tell, and I hope this has been a pleasant way to spend a Sunday evening, or at least a portion of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Thanks, Brent. Thanks, Mark.
You guys have all been terrific, and I really appreciate it. For listeners, we invite you to go to MormonMatters.org, not only for the conversation, but for the donate button that happens to be sitting there. We'd love to get a little more financial support for this program through either a monthly subscription for $2 or $5 or $10 a month, or whatever you feel like you can do, or to just simply make one-time donations whenever you're so moved to do so. It's a piece of a financial puzzle, and we're trying to build a larger community of open discussions like this, and anything that you can do financially to support that will be terrific. So thank you again, everybody. Good night, and we'll hopefully see you all on the blog.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.